This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, today on Dreamland, we're going to do something we literally have never done before. I don't think many people have. I came across a guy, too, actually, him and his wife, and it's only going to be him on the show, who are experts in, of all things, coma and the near-death experience. And I thought, what is that about? Well, we're going to find out, because we're going to be talking today to none other than Alan Pierce, who is the co-author of this fascinating book, Coma and the Near-Death Experience, The Beautiful, Disturbing, and Dangerous World of the Unconscious. He's a journalist, he's a broadcaster, a former BBC correspondent. He's the author of a number of other books. He has contributed to the Time Magazine, to the Sunday Times of London. Beverly, his wife, is a former private investigator who works, interestingly enough, as an aromatherapist now. They live in France. Either that's wonderful and lucky or not, depending on what part of France you're in.
Yeah, it depends how you want to analyze it. Parts of it are wonderful.
You decided to write a book about coma. And I thought to myself, this is fascinating, because my wife was in a coma for 6 weeks after her brain bleed in 2004. She had a near-death experience during the coma too. So this is something I want to learn more about. What inspired you to write a book about coma?
Well, I never set out to write a book about coma. What happened was, I'm a journalist and I'm always asking questions. And early on in COVID, I was watching the evening news, and yet more and more people are being placed into medically induced comas. And I thought, that's interesting. How does that work? And how does that benefit anyone? So I just had to look. And the official explanation goes like this, that deep sedation, prolonged deep sedation, i.e. coma, has been a critical part of critical care for the past 50 years, and that it provides the deepest form of sleep, a restorative form of sleep, that allows the body to rest as best it can, and that the drugs and nature do what they can. During COVID, especially, people, doctors would say that no patient on the mechanical ventilator can tolerate that whilst being conscious. People just fight the vent. And they also say that any events within coma just can't be there. They have to be a false memory or hallucination, because effectively the brain is offline. It's a bit like, say, having a desktop computer, unplugging it from the wall and expecting it to work in some way. It won't. The brain is now thoroughly offline. So everything they tell you, that it's sleep, it's restorative rest, you can't do it on without, you have to be sedated on the ventilator, and the thing should be a blank, all of that turns out to be wrong, every bit of it. Where would you like to go from there, Whitley?
Yeah, because I could not agree with you more. My wife had a near-death experience during her coma. But I want to, before we go on, I want to continue to set a little bit of stage. You gathered the information. The book's full of experiences. Can you tell us how you found coma survivors and where they were and what they were like?
Well, after listening to the medical explanation, I never won just to take, you know, the first answer as fact. So I just had to look a little further. So it seemed to me the best people to speak to would be the eyewitnesses, people who've been through coma themselves. It took me a while, but funny enough, on Facebook, there are a number of groups. The one in particular that allowed me entry was the Coma Survivors Group. And I sat in the shadows, as it were, and I watched people posting. And comas are supposed to be a blank. Well, people were recounting all sorts of things, but they were using medical terms such as delirium, hallucination, false memory, coma dreams. None of those things can actually happen. You can't hallucinate whilst unconscious. You can't be delirious whilst unconscious. So they were using all the wrong terms. The other thing that got me was that they all seem to have remarkably similar ailments. For example, extreme pain and muscle ache, inability to sleep because of the fear of going back to the very depths of hell, which we can talk about in a while. Balance, shocking memory loss, and just all around just inability to live life to the full the way they had before coma. So suddenly I'm seeing alarm bells ringing, and I'm wondering, how is it that no one else has seen these before we came along? I then managed to talk to individual coma survivors, and it's not an easy thing, because what people experience within coma, when they come out of it, no one's explained to them what they've been through. So invariably, they think they've gone mad. Now, it could be they, like your wife Anne, had an NDE, and it may have been a beautiful thing, which could have given them a positive life experience. However, without any guidance, they can still think they're mad. Equally, events within coma, and we can talk about the different types, sometimes they're horrendous, and people truly think they've gone mad. So they don't even tell their nearest and dearest. So in order to get people to talk to me, we had to speak for many cases for months at a time. And I told them the things I was finding out, and then bit by bit, people would open up to me. And the stories they told me, which are in the book, which form a large part of the book, are beyond anything, beyond the human imagination. No scriptwriter could ever make the stuff up. It is so off the scale.
Well, I have read the book, and I am... I'm thinking, Anne had an NDE during her coma that changed her life completely. After that, she was a different person in a good way. And it opened the door in her to another world. And she stayed like that after she came out of the coma. She didn't have any lasting memory loss or anything like that. She came back pretty much completely. But then years later, she began to die of a brain tumor and began to ask me to do strange things, like memorize a certain poem, Song of the Wandering Angus. And after she passed on, it turned out that she had been planning from the January of 2015 until August of 2015 when she died, her return. She knew how to do it. I mean, isn't that amazing? I mean, and are we not talking about people who come to the edge? You've got a lot to say, so I'll just shut up.
Oh, well, oh yeah, I can fully understand this. I've spoken to people who have died, clinically died, been resuscitated within the intensive care unit, sometimes, in one case, four times. They have died and they have come back. And a number of them have had the classic near-death experience. And once you've seen that, you know life goes on. You just know. There's no two ways about it. It's abundantly self-evident. And I dare say this is what Anne felt. And she also, when she was there, you learn things. You don't always have the ability to come back with this knowledge that you do learn, but you know that you've learned something vital, something important about the meaning of life and why we're here. I very much imagine that this is what Anne saw on the other side.
Well, she didn't, on the other side, Anne being Anne, everything was always very practical and down to earth. What she felt she'd seen on the other side was she was found herself in what looked to her like a bus station. And there were a lot of people sitting around with bags and suitcases and stuff. And her lesson that she had brought back from that was that And she was told, you can go on or you can go back. And she chose to come back because her family wasn't finished. Her son and his fiance weren't married and they didn't have children. They weren't married yet. They didn't have children. And one of the first things she did when she came out of ICU psychosis was she said, we've got to get to my son. We got to get this family going. And that's why she came back, to be the grandmother and the head of the family. And she did that.
It's interesting. She was at a bus station, a terminus.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, the bus station, it's a terminus, exactly. And the people had all of these burdens. And when she came back, her lesson was to everyone who would listen to her, you've got to put those down in this life. Because you can't put them down once you're over there. Then you're going to have to come back. So put your burdens down, she said. She was a spiritual master, but not a pretentious one. She was a very unpretentious, down-to-earth spiritual master, but the real deal for sure. And
can I just say, she was able to interpret that because of that knowledge, wasn't she?
Of course. Yes, exactly.
Whereas the majority of people in coma have events like that. And I'm going to speculate that Anne's experience was more real than real, with ultra clarity, that people who experience that honestly think they go mad. They've gone mad because there's no point of reference. No one gives you a pamphlet at the end of this.
Well, tell us some of the stories. Just choose one. There are a lot of stories of this experience of thinking that you've gone mad, which never occurred to Anne at all. But give us an example of a coma witness. I don't know which story to pick.
Okay. I mean, they form sort of different groups. Some are like NDEs, as we generally think of an NDE. Some are so appallingly dark. Others involve alternate lives. Now, for example, if you have, a past life regression, you go back and maybe you witness that life or you are aware of it, but you're not living it minute by minute. Some people within coma are having alternate lives that span decades. They live them minute by minute. They have all the normal things one expects in life. They hold down jobs, they get married, they have kids, they go on vacation, they live life to the full. And then in one particular instance, Nick in the book was living this life. It started to get a bit stressful. I think he was having a heart attack, collapsed, woke up. When he opened his eyes, the people around him, his family, were not his family. He didn't recognize any of them. And he had another family in this other life. And it took him a long time to come to terms with which was real, the one he's in now or the one he's just left. And he seriously thought he was mad. And as he said to me, my family wouldn't come out and say so, but they thought I'd gone insane.
Did this continue for a while after the coma? Because when Anne first woke up from ICU psychosis, which she went through big time, when she was first disintubated, they asked her name, and she remembered her name. Then they asked her, who is this man standing here? And she looks at me and she says, I have no idea. And I couldn't tell, is she joking or not? And then the nurse said, this is your husband, Whitley. And she said, that can't be my husband. I'd never marry a man that ugly.
Thanks for sharing that.
But then she proceeded to descend into ICU psychosis. And I guess the question is, those who have these terrible experiences during the coma, can you characterize it? Because she only had the NDE, and it was like everything that happened with Anne, it was a teaching tool. Anne was the best teacher in the world. But tell us some of these stories that, you know, people have alternate lives. Do you think they really have those lives?
No, I have no way of proving this one. I've managed to prove a whole bunch of things in the book.
Yes,
I don't think we'll ever be able to prove. If anything, I think they're having past lives. They're going back and experiencing past lives. They're never set in the future. They're never actually set in the now. Sometimes they go back so far. One guy told me he looked really good in the Georgian wig. People are in all these different times. And in the case of Nick, the story I just told, he was reliving his time in the 1960s and 1970s in Midwest America. He even got called up for an alternate Southeast Asian war and did a combat tour there within his coma. Other people have told me, for example, there's a composer in the book, Stephen Watkins. Within his coma, he was spending most of his time in the Caribbean, having a very nice time. And he defines himself as a musician, as a composer. And he was precisely that there. And he says, in this world, he's very keen on sailing. And he was doing a lot of that there. And it is so strange. So these are real lives. Whether that was an alternate life, whether that was an idealized life that he somehow his mind conjured up. These things I don't think we'll be able to explain. When people are placed into a coma, it's not as if there's a one-size-fits-all coma tablet. It's different things for different people. All sorts of things about a person will make their reaction to the coma different. Some people will just bubble beneath the surface. And the way of measuring the depth of coma is virtually primitive. It's not even like a thermometer where you can read a number. It's almost guesswork. So some people who they think they've dosed up heavily are just floating beneath the surface. They're paralyzed. They're aware of virtually everything around them in real time. They can't even blink or scream. Sometimes people are completely in the dark with full consciousness, no feeling, nothing, just a brain, as it were, or a mind in complete and utter darkness. In the book, there's the story of a 15-year-old girl who found herself after a road accident stuck like this. And she's just saying, where's my mummy? Why doesn't my mummy come and wake me up? This is ridiculous. I've been sleeping far too long. Then you can go slightly deeper where the events around you within the hospital start weaving into these nightmarish events. So the very kind doctors and nurses who are really trying to save your life, your mind is portraying them as murderers and torturers. And that just gives people the most abject horrors. And when people have small operations or having their teeth cleaned, it's perceived as some ghastly torture. So there's a whole range. And on top of that, there's the beautiful ones where people are literally in heaven. But it varies from person to person.
Now, it's interesting. My question, and this was a question I wondered whether I should ask or not, because you don't explore it directly in the book. Why is there this difference? Some people have absolutely horrendous experiences in coma, and then there are some beautiful stories in here.
Yeah, I don't think anyone can really explain that.
No.
One guy, his name is Rory. He's a Brit. He was in an horrific home invasion, and he was beaten over the head with a hammer, and he had an abdominal wound and so forth. He was airlifted unconscious into hospital. Now, he had the most appalling events within coma, so bad that he says they were far worse than the actual home invasion. So he puts that down to, and his psychologist that he spoke to, put the appalling events down to what happened to him immediately prior. And then you've got other people who've just come out of a normal life, just suddenly, you know, they've collapsed in the street, they say, with a heart problem, and life's fairly normal, nothing is upsetting them. And they're equally having appalling nightmares. And the things they come up with, you know, there's Deborah in the book. If you say to Deborah, how long were you in your coma? In the terms of the hospital, I think she was about 3 weeks. If you ask Deborah, she would say, I was 80 years in my coma. And she lived an entire existence, and this is so strange that you can't make it up, as a living mannequin in a serial killer themed bar where nightly they reenacted murders, rapes, and all manner of horror on her night after night after night. And in that period, she gave birth to three children, and she was able to gauge the measurement of time. They're so strange. And she just came out of a fairly normal, happy life into that.
Now, did you look into, and I don't remember reading this in the book, did you look into whether or not such a place ever existed or exists?
Nick, for example, in his Midtown, it's kind of generic Midwest, you know, America. There were certain features about it. The town produced an ice cream of a peculiar pink color, which he was very attracted to. Other than that, when he also said that it was very much like America, but not like America on a map. Things weren't exactly in the right place. Things were just slightly different. And he also said, whereas our atmosphere is blue, the atmosphere in this alternate life was slightly orange. And I don't know what to make of this, but over and over, different people have told me about the color orange being a major feature within their coma. And that's,
Do you suppose that we have parallel lives in another universe in which the atmosphere of the Earth is orange?
I certainly can't discount that. I mean, I've listened to
some. God, I mean, this is so fascinating.
This seems entirely likely. It seems entirely likely. But I think what we found here with coma, it's like a gateway that no one's ever bothered to explore before. It just opens up to all these different worlds. Some we know, like the near-death experience. These nightmarish worlds are not like anything. Others go back in time, and they're having dinner with their family and tasting everything and joining in the conversation. And that's not like anything. And finding parallels is very, very hard.
Yeah.
Well, but also, yeah. There are mechanisms which we can talk about as to why certain things happen. For example, if you're experimenting with psychedelics, you can switch off a key part of the brain known as the default mode network. It regulates our conscious reality. The same thing happens in the deepest states of meditation. The network is switched off. It's been demonstrated to switch off within coma. And that leads to an expansion of consciousness. So people within a coma, when they're experiencing things, some of that can be explained in the same way that psychedelics can be explained, because the mechanisms are the same. Additionally, the human body produces its own psychedelic compound. I won't try and pronounce it, so I'll just call it DMT. Doctors can find it in the system. Doctors can detect it in the system, but they can't find where it's produced, and they certainly can't explain why. If you look at the urine of people suffering from schizophrenia, they have high levels of DMT in their system. DMT is the active ingredient in the Amazonian mystic brew, ayahuasca. People that take ayahuasca are recounting the same events, similar events, to those of people within coma. It can also, and we've demonstrated in the book, DMT can be triggered by putting yourself into the deepest forms of sensory deprivation, which incidentally coma survivors are also in. When you monitor people within that situation, they're reporting very much the same events within coma. They are reporting nightmarish events. They're reporting exceptional beauty. And in some cases, they're revisiting past lives.
We're going to take a short break, folks. We'll be right back. So we're talking about what I think could be described as the releasing of the consciousness from the default mode network, which is where the ego is. And when that happens, it becomes loose in reality somehow, but it doesn't lose itself completely. There are lots of people, though, whose comas are just black. They don't remember a thing. That's correct, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, it's impossible to say whether they're in the minority or the majority, because those people that I've managed to make contact with haven't tried to make contact because they had a blank in their lives that they're told to expect. They've made tried to make contact with others because they've experienced these strange things.
Yes.
So it stands to reason I'm more likely to find them. But gauging that's almost impossible. Of the 20-plus coma survivors who helped us with the book, it's fair to say that two of them had proper blanks within their coma. Each, however, were left with problems. One physically, he's actually fine, which is remarkable considering all the other survivors I've spoken to. The other one, a female, had lost so much of her memory, just vast gaps, and just not knowing what had happened, you know, at her birthday last week, not remembering a single bit of it. And it varies to so much for people.
Yeah, I'm just looking here. Let me see what the name of this chapter is. Just a second. I have a bunch of questions. The dark brings light, touching the void. And I think when I was reading that, this is saying the void isn't the void. It's something else. Can you expand on what you think is in there, in the sense that when you shut down the default mode network, you free the consciousness from the ego, and therefore from all of its assumptions and expectations about what the world around it is. Does that mean that it becomes free to simply imagine, or does it really go somewhere else, other places?
I don't think it's imagining. I think it really is. They really are going other places. I'll give you an example. We're talking of the psychedelic compound DMT. I spoke to a couple, a man and a wife, that took it together recreationally. And when they do so, they go to the same place together. A lot of people that do DMT one way or another report these entities, intelligent entities that they communicate with invariably telepathically. There's multiple types. One type, people sometimes call electric elves. These people call them tree elves. And there they were in the living room of their house. And one of these tree elves is playing with a record player and he's going to break it. And they're both watching that and they can both see it. Now, they've both gone somewhere. When people take ayahuasca, for example, the Amazonian brew, they're often going to realities that are virtually identical in terms of the experiences they have when they're there. They can't explain what it looked like. Sometimes they have no visuals. And also, it's what people say, it's ineffable. There are no words to describe these things. But clearly, they are going to the same place. When, for example, one doctor gave DMT to shamans in the Amazon who are familiar with ayahuasca, they said, these are the spirits we work with. We know this place. So, yeah, I think they're going somewhere.
No, excuse me. What do doctors, I know the brain, because I was with a coma victim. I lived with my wife. I slept, if you can believe it, on the floor of the hall outside the ICU when she was in her coma. And I wasn't alone. There were no wives out there, but a fair number of husbands. And because, you know, we want to protect our gals. And so doctors, she was covered with leads, and there was a brain expert who would come and read her brain waves all the time, every few hours.
That's unusual. That is really unusual.
It is.
Oh, well, yes, utterly.
Maybe it isn't in this country, but maybe they don't do it in England.
I mean, predominantly, my research took place in the US. But it's global.
So
no
they don't
one has
actually...
ever said that. No. When I spoke to Dr. Wes Ely, professor of medicine at Vanderbilt, he had put people on an EEG brain scanner and later in an MRI scanner, and had been horrified by what he'd seen. And he came to being the first, certainly the first he'd ever heard of people doing that. And by looking at people who'd been in coma for some time, he gave me the example of a young woman. I think she was like 35. She was a mathematical whiz. After her coma, she couldn't even add up her checking account. Oh, she took another IQ test and came up at 100 as opposed to 140. When Dr. Wes Ely put her in an MRI scanner, parts of her brain had shriveled. She had the brain of a very old woman with dementia. She was 35 goodness. Or thereabouts. That's what he was seeing. When he was just reading the brain waves of people in coma, he was horrified how deep they were going because they were effectively dead. You can't say brain dead because that is something else, but their brain was effectively dead to the world. And that horrified him. And I don't think most doctors ever get the opportunity. In fact, I know for a fact, doctors do not get the opportunity to do that. So why they were doing it in Anne's case, I can't even begin to
imagine. Well, you know, I could be wrong about it because my memories are not perfect about that time, too, because of the trauma that was involved. It could be that they didn't start reading her brainwaves until after she... I remember now. She had brain swelling because of the blood that got into her brain from the stroke when she had the brain bleed, and the monitors were there to detect the level of what was happening to the brain, because they were doing this
that would make sense, because that's a specific issue that they're looking for.
So that was why
you
were there.
You had COVID, they would not be looking at that, for example.
Later, though, they took them off. That was when they put her into a really deep state. And that was when I think she had the near-death experience. Because they eventually took them off because the brain bleed had was resolving normally. I mean, the swelling was resolving normally. And her, I don't know what her, I never asked what her brain state was, but she was still kept under sedation because she was intubated for about another 3 weeks until the brain was completely recovered. Then she was disintubated and proceeded to have a fantastic case of ICU psychosis. It just started with her announcing that she didn't know who I was. And she was completely talking about another reality and all kinds of things that really didn't make sense. And the neurologist said to me and my son, he said, she's got to have 24 hours a day because she's not going to sleep for days. And you guys have got to spell each other. And every time she comes up with something that doesn't make sense, you have to tell her that. You have to read the newspapers, all of this.
Sorry. I'm so sorry. No, because automatically the default for a doctor here is not to look for any spiritual explanation. The automatic thing is to say it's a blip. They call it ICU delirium, ICU psychosis.
That's exactly what they call it.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't even understand what that means anyway, to be frank. It's a catch-all. It covers so many things.
She was terribly happening. I mean, she was talking about all these weird things.
Of course, and people do. But they dismiss it as if it was some form of mental illness. Whereas if somebody had a near-death experience, you and I know not to treat that as a mental illness. A doctor does not know to treat that as a mental illness. And this is the problem. They do not look for the explanations that we have discovered in this book. There are perfect explanations for how things are happening. The answer of why do we have a near-death experience? Why does Nick have an alternate life? These we cannot ever hope to explain, I imagine. But doctors have got to look beyond the simple dismissive things. You know, I read today that the events that people experience after coma, where their bodies don't work, where they've lost vast amounts of memory, rather than explore this in its own right, they're now marking this down as long COVID, even for people who didn't have COVID. And it's like how to brush something under the carpet and not explore the problems. In the book, we explain why people are getting the events that are happening. I don't know specifically about Anne's case, but what seems to happen in ICU, before they even put you in a coma, you are not getting sufficient sleep. No one in ICU gets sufficient sleep. You're lucky if you even get 2 hours a day.
That's three right. She was waked up every few minutes.
Yeah. 3 days of that, you go into massive sleep deprivation. This leads to acute brain failure. The longer you're in that state, the greater the damage that will be caused. Equally, if you're in a coma, you're not sleeping. Doctors call it sleeping, but your brain, because it's unplugged, is not going through its circadian rhythms. You are not getting REM sleep. No one is sleeping within a coma. Again, they're getting acute brain failure through sleep deprivation. This is just simply not understood. It's so easy to figure it out. You walk into an ICU unit, you say, how much sleep does this person get a day? They're not getting a good 6 to 8 hours. Therefore, they are going to be sleep deprived, but it's not treated that way. It's remarkable. And when you're in that state, you will imagine all manner of things. Reality, the world around you in the hospital, will weave into something your mind is doing and turn it into a horror show. Or a weird reality. One person told me, because they propped her up on a red cushion, she thought she was the Pope. And because everyone was looking at her with some kind of expectation, waiting on her every word, she really, really felt she was the Pope. people will get these delusions, but that's not a coma. That's just from being in ICU.
Well, that's what happened to Anne. She had that, but once she came out of it, the first thing she started talking about was the near-death experience. And that, as I say, it changed her life. She would tell anyone who she felt was on the right journey about it. And she would always say, you have to put those burdens down in this life, because once you're on the other side, you can't. And of course, that means living a whole different kind of life. It means basically a self-examined life. And she used to say the one thing that the Western world said right, that we all ignore, is the motto on the wall of the temple at Delphi, know thyself. But if you don't know yourself, you might not be able to go on. Interesting, isn't it?
It's all remarkable. For me, yeah, I feel like we've discovered something that no one has ever bothered to explore for the last 50 years when it's been medical practice. No one has ever bothered to explore it. And
you have
very quick to dismiss exactly. Things. Well, we have, because it's taken a journalist, me, and a private investigator, my wife, B, to do what doctors or scientists should have done. They've not done it because modern critical care is now a conveyor belt of care, where no one's looking over their shoulder at the end product. They're too busy dealing with the next patient. And everyone's just shoved down the line into care facilities or whatnot. Often, they can't speak for weeks at a time because of damage to vocal cords from the ventilator. They wake up and they don't even know, who these people claiming to be their family are. It takes them a long time before they can then address any issue of a near-death experience. And then when they even begin to do that, they don't know where to start. Oh, by the way, hon, I've just had another husband and I've got 3 children that we didn't know about. It doesn't make sense. No one can openly say these things, so they keep them to themselves. What should happen? I'd like to see an end to prolonged deep sedation in ICU from here on. But if they were to continue it, or just to find the people that have been through the process, they need to debrief them. They need to explain to them what they've seen. In terms of someone who understood an NDE should explain to them what they've experienced. Other people who've been through the coma experience should be allowed to talk to people fresh out of coma or people about to go into coma, so they can tell them what to expect, so they don't feel completely cut off and mad. That said, there's almost only a handful of instances where it's generally agreed coma is a good thing. Certain kinds of brain seizures, you want to switch the brain off. Certain injuries, such as abdominal, and after certain heart operations, complications. And even then, it's a trade-off, because you're causing irreparable harm to the patient because of the sleep deprivation. Simply one thing, you know, we used to think that bed rest was the best thing, and it's been that way for thousands of years. We've all thought this. Modern medicine has discovered that just 1 week of bed rest can result in the loss of 40% of lean muscle in 1 week. And this is not noticeable in people in coma who've been there for, say, 2 to 3 months, because they're so pumped full of fluid, you can't see the muscle wastage. So it's small wonder they can't walk when they get up. And this is also damaging. And it turns out that it's not even necessary. There's no medical literature or scientific literature that advocates prolonged deep sedation ICU. All modern literature decries the practice with a vengeance. They call it lethal. They call it damaging, and they call for it to be stopped. Unfortunately, people don't seem to be paying attention, and they're not paying attention because they don't see the damage that they're causing.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, well, wait a minute. We have come to the end of the free part of the show. The show has a free part and a part that continues for subscribers. So we've come to the end of the free part of the show. And as always, I would like to thank those who listen to the free part only for joining us. I hope you enjoyed it. And when we get back, something has come up in my mind. Alan has brought up something that jogged a very old memory of mine. When I was in the ICU and I had a past life experience that I've never spoken about before at all. And I'm going to run through that and see what you think of it and how it compares to other people who have had this same thing. So, Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for being with us, and subscribers, we'll keep right on keeping on. Back in 1979, I had a phenomenal appendicitis. I'm a person who tends to bull their way through pain. And unfortunately, I was in Texas, and unfortunately, the emergency room I went to, because I had a great deal of pain, they were not very good. And they figured, they said, well, you've just eaten too much Mexican food, it'll go away. It didn't go away because I had appendicitis. In fact, it became infected and then gangrenous. And then the appendix fell off into my peritoneal cavity. And at that point, I thought to myself, something more is wrong. This isn't indigestion.
Yes, I'm going, you could say that,
insane with agony. So Ann called the hospital, and they took me back on an emergency basis. This was, of course, when was it? It was July the 4th weekend. And my theory is that nothing serious happens to people except on long weekends and holidays. And I know that's ridiculous, but that's how I felt at the time. So I was taken into emergency surgery and sedated very quickly, but not well, so well that I lost my, in other words, I didn't blank out. And I could hear them talking to each other. And they were yelling and reacting when they opened me up to the stench of rot. And, oh, God, and going on like that. And I thought, this can't be good. I couldn't move and I didn't have any sensation. I didn't feel anything. But I could hear everything they were saying. Later, when the surgeon came and saw me, I said, was I supposed to hear you talking? And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I heard you talking, and I said some of the things that they'd said, and he went white. He said, I can't believe it. I've never heard anything like that. I said, well,
no, that's crazy. That you see, this is the problem. This is the root of the problem. Within the number of people I interviewed, a number of them were able to witness events happening to them within surgery.
Of course, I think that's not uncommon.
Exactly. So why would a doctor say that? They say that because, quite frankly, they can't get their heads around it. Right? It just doesn't fit. It just doesn't fit. So you hallucinated that one, I'm afraid, Whitley. Right? You didn't experience that, so a doctor would tell you.
Well, yeah, but I didn't hallucinate it because he was appalled that I knew I could quote what he said.
Oh, people were telling me specifics of an operation and how nurses and doctors are reacting within the surgery when they're supposed to have been completely out of the picture. Now, there's no way. Another one traveled alongside his body on a gurney, and he watched two medics fumble to get a stent into his heart. And that's all provable because of the records with the first stent thrown away and another one used and so on.
This is really common. Interesting. I know some doctors who are completely, my own personal physician has no problem believing that. But he says, I'm not supposed to believe that there's a soul. But why not?
Because it's not
what is it about the science that draws this artificial line?
They can't
in the
find
sand?
It. It's like this. It's like consciousness, for example. Right? We're all conscious now. Right? Every minute we're conscious. And you ask a doctor or a scientist to explain consciousness to you, they haven't got the first clue. Ask them where their mind is. They may point to their forehead. But if you look inside, it's not there. And nor's the soul. So they tend to ignore those things. They don't concentrate on them. And if they do, they're very, very dismissive of them. And everything they say about the mind or consciousness are no more than theories. They're not facts. No one has any understanding of it. Therefore, they can't understand our current level of consciousness. They haven't got the first clue how to explain levels of consciousness experienced by people having a near-death experienced by people in coma at whatever level. They haven't got a clue. So they simply dismiss it. You hallucinated. You had delirium or psychosis. It's a false memory. It will pass. Next, please.
Too bad that they're themselves so starved. You know, it went on, though, and I want to finish the story because after I was out of the surgery and in the ICU, I began to have a long memory, a past life memory of some kind, that it took place in the 20s and 30s and ended in 1945, just before I was born. And it was of being a gangster, a young man in his 20s, and I stole a lot of money from the boss. And I got on a bus in Manhattan and went to Kentucky, to Louisville, Kentucky, where I lived for years very happily. But they hadn't forgotten me, and they caught up with me. And in 1945, a car drove up beside me, and someone leaned out with a shotgun and gut shot me. And I knew this individual's name and everything.
See, that's so detailed, isn't it? You know that you don't have a false memory that goes like that.
No, and
can I ask how you experienced it? Did you experience it in real time, or were you like?
No. I experienced it as a series of life memories, like you would if you were looking over your life in old age.
Okay, right. And there's slight differences within coma. People who experience them as we're experiencing the movement of time now.
They're living it.
They're not witnessing it. They're living it minute by minute. And if they get frostbite, it hurts. If they drink a margarita on a cruise ship, they can get high, and so on.
Well, I didn't. I don't want to keep on with this story, but to make a long story short, I did know the name of the person, and I was able to look this person up, and I couldn't find out anything about how they died. But their family still lives in the city. And so in some way it was, I don't know whether it was really a past life of mine or I was simply locking onto someone else's life. I have no idea. But I want to get back to this business of the meeting, the other worlds. like the one with the orange sky. And I wondered when you said that, why does that ring a bell with me? I don't know why it rings a bell with me. But you've had a number of people who have been to this world with this sky, this different sky. That would mean the planet has a different kind of atmosphere than this one.
Sometimes it's a form of light, like a glow of light. You know, people often see a bright white light. But in many cases, people are getting an orange glow. Nick, the atmosphere was orange. Nick also saw colors that we can't see with our eyes. Now, that seems very hard to explain. He, at one point, was falling through a rainbow of, he called it blue, he called it orange, but not blue or orange as we know it. And he would fall through one color and come out soaking wet and fall through another color. It's just, it crops up. It's not always just the atmosphere, as in Nick's case. It's just a color that crops up. I have no idea of its meaning. Perhaps somebody reading the book can help explain it to us.
Yeah. Could it be that we have more than one life at the same time and some of them are in maybe parallel universes or even on other planets? I mean, we just don't know what we are.
It's a theory, isn't it? It's a theory like so many others, and you can't discount it. I'm more inclined to think that, say, in this case and possibly in yours with that much detail, that this is a past life. And so many within coma have told me of their past life. It's curious you had your death there, because more than one coma survivor told me, almost it's as if they're reading off a catalogue. I had this life, I died. I had that life, I died. I had this life, I died. But they don't just die of, I don't know, simple things like in your sleep comfortably. They're dying by drowning. They're dying by being shot. They're dying by some terrible accident. But living it, actually living it as it's happening, and going through the horror of dying over and over again on a loop.
Oh, my God.
And so many of them have told me this. And others were being... Another thing that crops up is that people are in an organ harvesting facility, and that they're being bred for organ transplantation, and that they have this life, they're put down again, they have this life, they're put... And this goes on, and they're stuck like this in loops. And when people come out of a coma, when people, the hospital tries to bring them out of a coma, more often than not, they're thrashing, they're fighting, they're biting the tubes, they're ripping the tubes out of them, because they're coming out of these appalling incidents of torture and chase. What is the first thing the doctor or nurse does? They put them back down again, kindly thinking that they're sparing them something, but they're sending them straight back into this horror show.
Oh, my goodness. We really don't know what we are, and we don't know each other at all. You know, they always say that people are switched off by a coma-inducing sedatives. And, you know, I've had a number of surgeries in my life. I'm 78, and inevitably, I'm sure you have too. Or if not, then you're lucky. In any case, when they give you the anesthesia, usually it is literally like being switched off.
Yeah, and it's only for a few hours, isn't it? It's not for a few weeks or months.
No, a few hours.
And it is more or less, depending on availability, the same drugs in both instances, in surgery and in coma. And what they don't like to do, you'll notice, is give people general anesthetics these days if they can avoid it, because they have noticed a decline in cognitive ability. Again, tens of points have been wiped off people for just having that bypass surgery. And they don't like to talk about it. It's actually a hospital-acquired condition. It's not covered by insurance. So people then tend to keep it quiet. And this is precisely what's happening to people in coma. People are being damaged by these drugs. For example, you know, a popular coma drug is propofol, and it's thought to have killed Michael Jackson, the king of pop. Right. And when you're in a coma, your circadian rhythms are not working. And your kidneys, which work on a 24-hour cycle, are not working on any cycle. They're not removing the toxins. They're not removing the drugs from your system. They're building up in your system. An awful lot of people in coma have kidney failure, by the way. And this builds up to such a shocking, shocking level. And the after effects, just by taking it like for a few hours or a few days under prescription or whatever, these people are taking a dangerous drug with the most appalling side effects for vast periods of time. It's not being flushed out of their system, and it's causing all manner of damage to them mentally and physically. And for some reason, doctors will not even begin to examine this. It is exceptionally rare to find any doctor working in ICU who's ever followed a patient home to see how they fared. It's exceptionally rare. We were lucky to track down a few in our book, and they were horrified by what they saw.
In what way? Why horrified?
Because they thought that they were saving people in intensive care. They went in with one kind of ailment, and now they've got a whole other kind of ailments, hospital-acquired ailments, that they can't function. They've forgotten the use of language. They certainly have to learn to walk, talk, feed, use a knife and fork, all of those things coming out of a coma. But this persists for a long time, and there's giant holes in their memory. They're racked with pain, having been pumped for the propofol. They've got all the withdrawal symptoms with propofol without even knowing that they've necessarily been on propofol. Mm-hmm. They've got myalgia, that they've got nerves that have disconnected. You've got skeletal damage, joints have calcified. All of these things are happening to people, and they need not happen because there's a much, much better way of doing this, as recommended in all the current medical literature, which is not to deeply sedate people for a long period, for exceptionally short periods of time, not to sedate them on a ventilator, and to get them as active as possible, because mobility and human interaction are key elements in recovery. And this has been forgotten. When patients are being treated like sacks of potatoes in a bed and turned every 2 hours, there's no connection with the nurses. The patient themselves is not invested in their own recovery, and it's lethal. And because of COVID, because of the sheer numbers of people being put into coma, they've discovered just how lethal it is. And it is appallingly lethal, either within coma itself or shortly after discharge. But doctors are ignoring it because they're not looking over the shoulder at the damage they are causing.
Now, you bring up a number of alternatives to medically induced coma in the book. Can you talk to us a little bit about those alternatives?
I mean, yeah, for example, if you're placing somebody onto a mechanical ventilator, if they, you can speak to them up front and talk to them and explain the procedure and explain that we know if you want to stay conscious during this, you have a much better chance of leaving ICU early. It will not lead to cognitive damage, and you'll very likely be able to resume your normal job quite quickly. When they do that, you sedate people for a brief period of time to allow them to get used to the tube, which is now not coming as a shock to them. You gently bring them out of it. And then what you do, you try and have a loved one alongside them to stroke their hand, you know, to cuddle them, reassure them, keep them calm. And then within no time, they get used to the ventilator. Modern ventilators can be activated by the patient's breathing. It doesn't set its own pace. It allows the patient to set its pace. So it's not that uncomfortable. So there you are. You're sitting up right in bed. You can work on a laptop. You can use your phone to contact your family. They will have you up and about walking on a mobile ventilator on a little trolley behind you, get you to 100 paces here and there. Most doctors and nurses listening to this will probably say, I'm crazy. Absolutely crazy, because the people that try to introduce these systems are told that they're crazy. And yet, right, there is nothing, nowhere, advocating prolonged deep sedation. Entirely the opposite. But people will not get it in their heads. They simply think people cannot tolerate being on a ventilator, but they can. And they get out so much sooner. Instead of going to care homes after ICU, they're walking. Actually walking out and going home in the vast majority of cases.
You know, there's a case in the, there's many cases in the book. It's quite fascinating in that respect, folks. The one that really arrested my attention was the case of Kathy Drown. Because when she came back, she didn't feel she was human.
She Kathy's a very spiritual person. She's also a Christian, but very, very spiritual person. When she came back, she didn't recognize humans. She had no notion who she was or what she was. Her actual coma experience had been beyond delightful. I say she's a Christian. Archangel Raphael came to visit her. He would sit beside her in the hospital every day. Bizarrely, he had Rasta hair and bright blue eyes. He explained his Rasta hair because he'd been in the West Indies lately. And they communicated telepathically, and he told all sorts of things. And he said, I'm going to build you a raft of autumn leaves. Yes. And he floated them on the ocean, and Kathy is floating on a raft of autumn leaves on the ocean, and she's never felt so happy, so secure, so peaceful. And she wished she had died, to be honest. She wished she hadn't come back.
I know many people who have had situations when they were basically asked, do you want to come back or not? And generally the ones who said, I don't want to, of course, I don't know those because they didn't come back. But the ones who did come back always came back for family reasons. I couldn't tell whether Kathy was pulled back or she wanted to come back. I couldn't tell.
She met her relatives. She was actually standing, not at a pearly gate, but a pearly step, surrounded by clouds, as it were. She could sense her relatives. They spoke telepathically. They communicated with her that she had something vital to perform, that this was not her time, that she had to go back. She was not best pleased. And she went back, and she now says, I have no fear of death at all, because I know I'm going back there.
You know, another thing is and this comes up in a number of the stories in slightly different ways, the world not feeling real. You know, it feels
when,
like
when, you've had what you felt, in the case of, say, Nick, living in American Midwest, town with pink ice cream, doing a combat tour in Southeast Asia, and he comes back to this. No, it doesn't seem real. Other people will say everything's out of kilter. One person told me that she felt lost in time. Couldn't really define it as such, but she was just not in her time. And other people have just, it's so hard to really explain all these different feelings that people have, and they are so varied. No two are the same. People may have similar near-death experiences and talk of beautiful countryside and so on and so forth. Beyond that, there is no similarity between the events that people are recounting in coma, none whatsoever.
I just can't get away from the idea that there are other worlds that we visit when we're unmoored from our physical bodies, and that they're real in some ways. Some people go to this world that we would perhaps consider heaven or the world of the dead. Do people go to dark places? Yes, is the answer, and it would tell us some about that.
When they're in dark places, they're not, let's say, like Dante's Inferno. They're not any classic vision of hell. But often people have described their experience as being hell. Trapped in a loop, for example, being seemingly a punishment, one life after another, miserable, painful, grisly death after another. In some cases, people are just living appalling lives, or lives in which appalling things happen. One person in the book, James, one of his events was his wife and daughter went to a pop concert in Manchester in the middle of England, and there was a bombing, and he went through the rubble trying to find them. Now, that's like a real event. 2 months later, we had the Manchester bombing, the Manchester Arena, in which lots of young girls and mums got killed or injured. That was pretty odd. and his description of the events that he witnessed trying to find his wife and child in the mess looked very, very much to my mind like the TV footage I'd been watching. And he's not making this up. This has not affected him. He told me this amongst just tiny, just like a snippet, and I had to stop him, reverse him, get him to explain it, because he was telling me about other lives that he'd had, about recurring one of another wife just dying in childbirth over and over and over and over again. This being their form of hell, living a life like this, but in the worst possible parts of it, or the worst parts of multiple lives laced together over and over and over again, but not burning hell with, you know, grisly creatures and with pitchforks and, you know, and pointy tails, not like that.
I'd prefer that. What's happening to the sun? Goodness. And, you know, I think that I'm not the only person listening to you talk that thinks, my God, am I in that state? Is that why my life is so screwed up?
I think we're all here to learn lessons, quite honestly.
Right.
And bad lessons, as we know in this life, have generally more value than good lessons. So I'm sure we're here for that sort of reason.
You know,
people are suffering these events. I think it's part of a lesson plan.
I think so too. I've thought and thought and thought about releasing the burdens, as my wife suggested, and it isn't easy. It's not just, oh, I'm sure I've forgotten the burdens of my life. It is a matter of going deeply, deeply into yourself and finding what you're clinging to and what clings to you. To a degree in that light, but also in the light of your research, how can the experiences of coma survivors change our understanding of consciousness? You said earlier, we don't really know what consciousness is, and you're right. I mean, that's the classic hard problem, as it's called in the sciences. But you've got some interesting ideas about this. How can their experiences change our understanding of consciousness?
Well, first off, get this, you could talk to them. That doesn't happen. No one talks to them. So it's as if some people have gone to not another planet, but they've gone to another reality, or they've gone to another dimension, but you've chosen to dismiss it. Why not sit and talk to them properly? And you will see, as we've seen, there's patterns in this. There's certain triggers for these things. And people are really, really experiencing them, because the events that people are recounting to me in their comas today, you go back to the Egyptian Book of the Dead, many thousands of years BCE, and the events in there being portrayed in that book are the same events that people are experiencing within their comas. Something is clearly going on. People have been recounting events such as these, the near-death experience or whatever, since the dawn of time. The only thing they've not recounted that I'm aware of is living an alternate life in real time, having this life, having another life, lasting decades, or only weeks past in this life, and then jumping back into this life and continuing on. Can't find a parallel for that anywhere. For some of the other things, there certainly are parallels and no mechanisms. But so much of this is just not understood. I think we are the first people to explore this. And it is now an opportunity for people, brain scientists, people looking at artificial intelligence, doctors in ICU, all manner of people, to start taking these things seriously. Because we have credible eyewitnesses from the dawn of time, King Solomon, all sorts of people recounting these things. We must take them seriously. That's where we can begin to learn.
Well, they took them seriously in the past, but perhaps not in an accurate way, because they filtered them through their own understanding of reality.
Well, people would use them. Of course, people would use them for their own purposes. The Christian church, yeah, for example, you know, would turn these things into a vision of the Virgin Mary. And,
right.
And have the person that saw that, you know, canonized as a saint. So they would use it that way. At another time, a person having the same experience could easily have been rushed off to the madhouse and never seen again. So these things change over time. But the further you go back, the more seriously these things are taken and understood. And other cultures, you know, it's not just the Western one, other cultures believe, you know, take Native Americans, for example. Their knowledge of the afterlife is based on near-death experiences. The same near-death experiences people are having now in the Western world that people are having in Japan hundreds of years ago, people are having these same events. They need exploring and not dismissing.
How would we explore them?
Well, I would also want to spend a lot of time looking at DMT, this psychedelic compound that's in the human body, possibly in all mammals, and forms the basis of the Amazonian mystic brew, ayahuasca. And I would put teams of people together and send them on the same dose of DMT and see if they are active together in a role there. Because, as I said, I spoke to a husband and wife. They told me that they go off together on their adventures. I've spoken to a number of people that did ayahuasca in the Amazon. They went to the same places. I'll start exploring those. Because for sure, within coma, DMT is being released. DMT is being released, we believe, it is believed, as the spark for the near-death experience. It opens up a gateway in some way. At the very least, it's easing our passing. But for some reason, it appears to be opening a gateway, and people in coma are passing into that gateway.
Yeah, I think that when I often say in this show that when the default mode network is shut down, we can see the real world.
Well, I mean, every mystic and guru has been trying to find the off switch, right, since the dawn of time. Yeah. And you can do it through meditation. You can do it through psychedelics, and you do it inadvertently when you place someone in a medically induced coma.
I've often wondered whether or not schizophrenics, what they are in the sense, we always assume that this is all just the production of a disturbed brain, but maybe some of them, at least, are having experiences that are in some way real, just like someone, a coma survivor or something.
Aldous Huxley, the wonderful author and psychedelic explorer, said just that he believed schizophrenics had the default mode network wasn't discovered until 50 years after Aldous Huxley was exploring this world. He called it the reducing valve. And he speculated that within schizophrenic, the reducing valve was faulty in some way. It was allowing in too much consciousness as opposed to filtering it out. When people do psychedelics, you know, they're expanding their consciousness. And it would appear, certainly from Aldous Huxley's perspective, that schizophrenics are also experiencing a greater form of consciousness, but a reality greater, he said, than the mind could possibly bear.
Let me think now. I was going to ask a question I almost don't want to ask, but I
feel free to ask them all.
No, I'll ask it anyway. I am among a small number of people that I know who have been not just in other states. I've never taken any hallucinogenic drugs because there's something about my brain that the anatomy of my brain that is unknown. In other words, it's not a normal brain. It's very functional, and there's no disease process or deformity in it, but it isn't structured. As one of the neurologists who studied it said, in his entire career, he'd never seen anything like it, but it works really well. And there are there are times when apparently there is itself propels a lot of DMT. It builds up its own DMT, and like a schizophrenic, it has too much DMT in their blood, but it's only very episodic with me. A couple of times, this has been so powerful that I've physically ended up in another world. In other words, my physical presence has disappeared from here and gone elsewhere.
And that sounds like DMT.
And I wanted to ask you, you know a lot about DMT. Do you know any other instances where people have physically moved to another world for a period of time?
Different substances, for example, such as mescaline.
Yeah, in taking a hallucinogenic substance, they have physically and provably disappeared from this world before the eyes of others.
Okay, as in people in the room couldn't see them as such? No,
yeah, for sure.
I don't know. I had one person explain to me in the book that she was in a longhouse in the Amazon, and she had her own specific guide, and there were other people there. And she went off to this where it was like your typical alien abduction. There was tentacles in her head. They were pumping information in, sucking information out. But she was scared stiff because she couldn't feel herself breathing and pulled herself back. And she came into that room and no one else was there except her guide. The other people weren't there. In that case, people definitely going to places but being seen to vanish has not come across my radar.
Oh, dear, I was afraid of that.
you tell me. Yeah, you have experienced this or people have seen you
vanish. I have had that experience, yes. And I'm not going to go into it. My listeners already know about it, and I wrote about it, some of it extensively in a book called A New World. So there's no sense in going. I was just thinking that you've had so much contact with so many people who are kind of living on this edge that maybe you had come across another person who'd done that, in which case I was going to say off the air, I want to know their name. I want to meet them. But
yeah,
no,
you see, sadly, people need to share this information.
Yes.
You know, there's coma survivors listening now who didn't even know anything about what we've talked about tonight. They've been through it entirely on their own. It's a complete shock to them. You know, everyone is searching for information in one way or another. And yours is a good place to start. Hey.
Well, yeah, everyone is. And your book is full of information. So what I want to say to people is if you are a coma survivor or have a coma survivor in your life, do get the book without fail. It's the best book about coma for the layman ever written. There's no question whatsoever in my mind about that. If you are exploring consciousness, it's incredibly valuable also, because you, in exploring the edges of consciousness and its extreme states, we learn about what we really are. And boy, I thought that was just such a precious part of coma and the near-death experience. I want to thank you for writing it, Alan. And it's must be clear to you that we've come to the end of our time together. I've had a wonderful experience.
Oh, Alan. Whitley, thank you so much. I mean, I've really been looking forward to this. I've enjoyed your shows. And I read your book, The Hunger, way back, and I just thought that was just so good. So such praise from you is high praise indeed. So I really thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.